At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
Welcome to Going in Blind. I'm your host, Zach Tidwell. And my guest today first came on my radar because he spent 2.5 decades of his life mountaineering. But he's also an entrepreneur, and he set a world record several years ago that really piqued my curiosity. And he also expressed that he had some opinions on modern rites of passage and maturity in our culture today. And I wanted to pick his brain on it all and see where it went. Before we get into the show, though, I do have a couple quick announcements. My book is on the way. For those of you who are new to the show, I do have a wild background story, just like many of my guests, and I've seen that sharing it does save lives. So I wrote a memoir about it, and I am on the road to publishing. The best way to get announcements about that outside of listening to the show is to go to my website at zachtidwell.com and join the mailing list there. And if you're unfamiliar with what I'm talking about, you can also read a little bit about my story there. I'd also appreciate it if you help me grow the show. And the best way to do that outside of word of mouth is to leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening. If that happens to be on YouTube, subscribe to the show. And I know that sounds silly, but those ratings and reviews really do help boost this podcast in the different podcasting platforms' algorithms and help it get in front of new listeners. And we've had some very heavy conversations on here that people need to hear. But with all that out of the way, please welcome Tom Lancaster. All right, Tom, I told you I was going to put you on the spot a little bit. I know you had touched on, you believe that there is a maturity crisis today. So can you define what this maturity crisis is?
Yeah. Hi. First of all, thanks for having me on the show. It's great to be here. And yeah, let's start with a big one, hey?
Told you I was going to put you on the spot.
I love it. Yeah, we really do have a maturity crisis. Or maybe it's better to put it as an elder crisis. We live in a world that is operating from a teenage mentality, from an adolescent perspective of I am separate from everything and everyone, and I can only win if everyone else loses. I need to accumulate more. I need to go faster. I need to grow, et cetera, et cetera. Without any awareness of the implications and the costs of that. And so when I say we're operating from an adolescent perspective, and I'm talking about traditional cultures, indigenous cultures, what I would call a healthy culture, which most of us living in the West are very, very far away from. In a healthy culture, in your early adolescent years, you go on a vision quest. You have a bunch of initiation rites to welcome in adulthood. And those rites often involve solitude, danger, being away from the tribe and the village. And out in nature, sometimes for like a year. And what happens in those rites, in those passages, in those journeys, is pieces of us are revealed to us about who we are and why we are. Whether you want to call that your soul's purpose, whether you want to call that the meaning of life, whether you want to call it, you know, one of my teachers calls it your ecological niche.
And you're finding your lane in the world, being your ecological niche.
Yeah, exactly. So every being has a niche, whether it's a fir tree or a mountain or a fox. And we are the only species that has the capacity, the capability to not fulfill our ecological niche, right? You'll never see a fir tree wishing it was a river. And so this is what is revealed to us, is the poetry of who we are and how we coexist in this world. And along that journey, we are guided by elders who have walked that path, who have lived a life of connection and service. And that's what's missing from the world today, is we don't have any elders, because we've completely bought into this idea of humanism, right? That humans are somehow separate from nature, of individualism, that I can somehow achieve anything by myself. Outside of my environment. And so what that creates, and if you look at the political landscape, if you look at a lot of the leadership landscape, it's playground stuff is what's happening, right? It's bullying, and it's look at me, and it's, you know, you're the bad guy, and it's competitive, and it's like zero sum. I win, you lose. If I have half the pie, there's only half the pie left for anyone else. And so, you know, we have this idea, and particularly in the States, right? We have this idea of rights, right? I have rights. I have rights to a certain level of treatment. I have rights to a certain level of health. I have rights and I have rights and I have rights, right? But in a healthy culture, in traditional culture, they don't talk about rights. They talk about responsibilities, right? They have a responsibility to steward the land. They have a responsibility to work with all the different species to coexist. So in a nutshell, that's what I'm referring to. When I say we have a maturity crisis, is that we're all running around like a bunch of teenagers, trying to gather as much pie as we can. And yeah, it's not going very well.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a lot of this, and I think it almost the comment on the political landscape today, and specifically like traditional media and how a lot of our politicians are so public now, it's all playing into the algorithms that are everywhere, right? All of our feeds outside of, I guess, even to in some extent, podcasts are still cultivated through algorithms, but there are ways to circumvent that. It's not as bad as it is in a lot of other places, but we do a lot of that adolescent behavior. And I wonder, because I don't think individualism on its own is bad. And I couldn't tell if you agree with that completely. It sounded like you were speaking more in this selfish, very narrow lens that a lot of people have of the world today, specifically narrowed in on themselves. And I you know, it's another one of those things where is it that byproduct of social media, because we know that has there, you know, there's a lot of good that does come out of social media, but I think net wise, it's probably bad in terms of the effects that it has on people's ego, in terms of the effects that it has on people's mental health. Yes, the access to information is awesome, but we've seen over the past several years that even that access, you know, you get powers involved in driving the narratives, even at these big companies. And it's there's that side of it. I wonder how much of it does originally stem from that. And in coming back to what you had mentioned about the concept of elders, like obviously it's not like our elders, like our literal elders went away, like they're still here. We just don't have the reverence for them like a lot of other cultures do, like you had mentioned. And I think in, obviously it's speaking in generalities, which I put you on the spot, which like making you do that in this is where I'm saying that before I go into this, like, yes, I think largely we don't necessarily have that same reverence for our elders here, but we do, you know, you do see pockets of that. Like I'm around veterans a lot, and there's a camaraderie of being around other veterans, but specifically like when you find out, okay, that dude's a Vietnam vet, or there's somehow we ended up with a unicorn here. There's a World War II vet here. There is just a cherishing and an awe and an ungodly amount of respect that comes for those people in those settings. And so like, you know, there are still those places where that does exist. I think, largely speaking, like you're saying, it is accurate that we don't have that. And I'm curious, do you feel, or have you thought of where you think that may have stemmed from, where we started to separate from that, from actually having that respect?
Yeah. And it goes back a long way past social media. Like for me, it extends even beyond capitalism. You know, depending on who you talk to, anywhere from 8,000 to 12,000 years ago, someone put a line in the sand and said, "This belongs to me." Before that, everything was part of everything. There was no mine and there was no yours. But the moment we said, "This is mine and you can't have it," right? And this was part of the process of agriculture, right? Because until we were able to put seeds in the ground and have to stay there to let them grow, we had no reason for the concept of ownership.
I don't know, and I'm not saying this just to like push back for the sake of it.
At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
Really trying to understand where you're coming from on this. Like, you know, I don't know. I get what you're saying in the sense of, because you're drawing 8,000 to 12,000 years ago, you're saying is when we actually started cultivating plants and needed to set down somewhere, as opposed to this, our roaming cultures that we had in, you know, out on the plains or out on the Asian steppe or wherever. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was the beginning of the idea of property and the idea of money and the idea of wealth and the idea of power as we know it today.
But we were still, you know, animals, us included, because we are animals, and you've kind of touched on that too. Like we've always been territorial. I'm sure it was back in the caveman days, obviously it was still, hey, this is, you're in my neck of the woods. I'm going to kill you for it. There's males warring over females. There's men, or, you know, prehistoric men going in and probably killing off the offspring of other people. And it's so, I that's where, like, I don't know that this is necessarily a byproduct specifically of the rise of some sort of monetary system. And that's, I'm saying that too, because I want to understand specifically where you're coming from on some of that stuff outside of the.
Mm-hmm. I totally hear you. And there's an amazing book called Humankind by an author called Rutger Bregman, who's a Dutch historian. And So what you're talking about there, there's a theory called veneer theory. Are you familiar with that?
No. And I'm typing it in so I can look this up later.
So veneer theory says that civilization and the rules of civilization is a very thin veneer over the top of our base nature, which is somewhat as you just described, right? Violent, you know, aggressive, et cetera, et cetera. And so civilization is the only thing that allows us to cooperate and be friendly and all of that kind of stuff. In his book, Humankind, he basically dismantles that. And there's all kinds of experiments that have been done to prove it, right? The Stanford Prison Experiment, the Milgram electric shock experiment. I don't know if you're familiar with these, but these were experiments that were designed to prove that when you remove the rules, humans will default to their base nature, right? The prison guards will become psychopaths. The experimenter will turn the dial all the way up to XXX even after the screaming has stopped on the other side. Yeah. So there's new evidence that those experiments were completely rigged. And what he goes through in the book is all these examples that that disprove this common story, right? We have the, you know, the Lord of the Flies idea that if we're abandoned on an island, we become savages. And what he believes and what this book is about and the evidence that he presents is that it's just not true. And he refers to us in the book as homo puppy. And what that means is there's this question of why did Homo sapiens why did the Neanderthals go extinct and why did Homo sapiens survive, right? Because by all accounts, the Neanderthals had bigger brains, they were stronger, they were more intelligent. Why did they go extinct? And his theory is because Neanderthals were, as you described, aggressive, territorial, et cetera, whereas much like wolves, whereas humans are more like dogs, and dogs are wolves that have evolved to be friendly and have become much more successful on the planet than wolves have. And what he says is that humans are the same. Our base nature is actually to be cooperative, to be friendly, to be welcoming, to be inclusive. And that actually civilization, it's the opposite way around. Civilization and property and all of that things has put a wedge in between us and created conflict. And capitalism has come out of that, which, as far as I can tell, is designed to divide.
Is he, I mean, this almost sounds, because, you know, yes, there's some divisiveness that has arisen out of civilization, but there's also, you know, civilization provides the rule set upon which allows us to hopefully go out and not get murdered, because there's consequences that should deter most people from doing that, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's the same people who, okay, when I make an investment into X business, if they go public, they are legally obligated to give me my money back, which I do. I think the way that the legislation around that and the way that leads to those businesses being run grossly a lot of times, which is unfortunate. But like I do, there's a lot of benefits that come out of civilization. And I'm curious, I mean, is he an anarchist? Because it is his proposed solution to, and I'm going to do my best here not to just hone in on this, but I do, you know, when I heard you speaking specifically, it sounded like you were against capitalism, but you're also an entrepreneur. So I'm curious in understanding both sides of this, right? Like, because it's, you know, that's, I that's the point of these conversations, is I like learning and understanding different people's viewpoints. And I think there's a weird, there's an interesting dichotomy there at face value, at least.
Yeah, totally. And I'm, you know, I am very aware of my own hypocrisy, because you're exactly right. I am an entrepreneur and I do exist within a capitalist system. And, you know, I'm having a baby next month and I want to provide for my wife and for that baby, right? And what that means in this world is bringing enough money in to pay for the things that we need. At the same time, where we are today is that business, economy, investments, all runs on some form of extraction. We remove oil from the equation and life as we know it comes to a fairly rapid halt. And so my work is deeply rooted in how can we do better, right? There are huge benefits, as you mentioned, to capitalism, to democracy, to all of these institutions and systems and rules, right, that we live by, that, as you say, hopefully prevent us from getting murdered and mean that we get our money back when we invest in a business and all these other things, right? That we can see a doctor when we get sick and, you know, so many incredible benefits. But there are two big costs to all of that. One of which is, you know, the very well-known challenges that we're facing with the climate and is life on Earth going to continue to be sustainable? But the other piece of it, and I think what's relevant to this conversation and the question that you asked me right at the beginning, is how deeply rooted we are in separation and this idea that I am different to you and that we are different to them and that some are good and some are bad and that my actions, the only consequence of my actions is whether I get money from it or not. It's a massive simplification, but but inside of the model, that's ultimately what it comes down to, right? Companies make decisions not based on what's the impact in 100 years going to be. It's what's the profit going to be in the next 3 months. And that, to me, is a huge part of why we go through our whole lives chasing one thing, which is this concept of success. And when we cease to be productive in the workplace, we get shipped off to an old folks home, right? And, you know, you're probably very well aware of it. Being a veteran, you know, a lot of veterans get completely discarded when they finish their service, right? Sometimes at the age of 20, they like have a whole life to live and it's like no one's looking out for them anymore because they're not being productive. And I think that's endemic in our society, is we only have value if we can contribute to the economy. And so, you know, if I'm a carpenter and I get to 60 or 70 and my body breaks down, now I have no value. And because that's been my whole identity, everything that I've built my whole life around is building houses. When that's taken away, then I fall apart and my mental health starts to decline and my body starts to decline because I have no role. I have no purpose. I have no reason to exist anymore. And so it's a loop, because again, to come back to what I would call a healthy culture, the productive people are the ones who are hunting and gathering and maintaining the village and whatever else. And the elders are transferring knowledge onto the younger generation. So you have all the grandmas and grandpas are looking after all the kids. And
at Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
And it's a loop. So they are still part of the system. They're still engaged. Their health is much better. And the youth are learning respect for their elders, which I don't think is taught these days.
And having deep discussions with wise people that are prodding them down a path to get them to think about something, as opposed to just telling them something and saying things at them.
Yeah. And so if we are willing to take an honest look at things like the education system, the healthcare system, the education system as we know it was designed pretty much specifically to break children's spirit so that they would sit still and sit at a desk or sit at a factory machine for 8 to 10 hours a day. It's designed to squash critical thinking. It's designed to squash individuality and produce clones, right? Conformists who will do what they're told, who will think just enough to do the job, but not enough to question why they're doing that job. The healthcare system is really a sick care system. It's designed to keep people just ill enough that they'll keep taking the drugs, but not actually get better, right? Doctors in 2025 have 1 week of nutrition education in their 7 years of medical school, because it's a system that is built on a financial model, not a care model.
Yeah, we're treating the symptom and not the root. And that's how the rarity of fitness and diet to be brought up in an actual, in a context outside of, you know, maybe when someone has high blood pressure or high cholesterol or just had a heart attack or something like that, discussion doesn't come up, especially in something that is less or more abstract than that, where it is mental health or something like that. It is such a, and I don't know how much of it is because of the kind of media that I consume. It seems like this is starting to become more common knowledge and that people are starting to talk about it, but that is not going to change the systems themselves. Like you're absolutely right on that regard. Yeah.
Yeah. The systems aren't changing. People are waking up, but the systems aren't changing. And it's, I would say it's even deeper than that. You said it's treating the symptom, not the cause. I don't think it's even, that's not the goal. The goal is to make as much money as possible. And so the treating the symptom is not the goal. That's the method to achieve the goal of making as much money as possible.
It's the business model of the long-term prescription, which is a subscription-based model it's monthly recurring revenue of, all right, your insulin is going to bring us in $2,000 a month. Also, we're doing some shady stuff behind the scenes with the profit benefit managers at the insurance companies. And
because that money is investing in Lockheed Martin and BAE Systems and going off to bomb people all over on the other side of the world. And so the question for at the heart of everything for me is, how do we as a society, as a species, how do we wake up? Because we've been sleepwalking. We've been living in a dream of individual achievement that is a myth. and communities are suffering, relationships are suffering, health is suffering, the planet is suffering, animals are suffering, like everything is suffering. And all the turmoil that we're seeing in the world, the way I like to look at it is it's the last like grasp of a system that is dying.
Yeah, we're seeing population decline in basically every civilization, whether it's, you know, we're not necessarily getting hit with it yet, but like Japan is going to start getting hit with it hard here. China is obviously seeing the outcomes of the one child policy that lasted for however long. South Korea is going to start having an issue with this. We're going to start having an issue with this. Like it is, we are on a weird precipice here for sure. Mm-hmm. With all of it.
And the people who have benefited so massively from the system for the last 100, 200, 300 years can see that it's falling apart and that change is coming. Like, I genuinely believe that something big is coming that we have no way of knowing because it's like completely outside of our awareness right now. But, and I'm not big into astrology, but all the astrology points to this as well. I'm not an expert, so we'll do everyone a disservice if I even try and explain it. But
you do a better job than me, but you could skim over it, but you're good.
But there are obviously the planets and the stars are all moving around and there have been periods of great turmoil on the planet that have all happened in a similar astrological setup to where we're entering right now. So the French Revolution, the American Civil War, World War II, the Declaration of Independence, like all of these things that were incredibly disruptive and painful were all awakening experiences, right? Even World War II, what came out of World War II was the National Health Service in Britain, was the United Nations. Whatever you think about how that's going right now, it was set up as a way to prevent war ever happening again.
Yeah.
And so there was this huge wound and then this huge collective global healing. And whatever is happening right now is that process playing out again. And so there will be an awakening. There already is an awakening. And it might be pretty painful on the way.
And it's interesting with that. Like I'm not someone who, and I have a hard time in general, you know, with stuff like that. It's like, there are so many scammy people out there that boast a lot of the, you know, whether it be astrology or profits or whatever, where it is like, I'm sure, you know, there's been real people with skills along those lines and with the means of interpreting these things, or maybe having contact with a higher space or entity somewhere and things like that. But there's so much BS out there that I'm so skeptical about everything with that, where I always, I'm dismissive of all, vastly dismissive of it, because there are so many shitty people taking advantage of those things. But it is interesting with that, like these, even we've seen like ancient cultures, like the megalithic structures in Egypt, a lot of them are aligned with weird places in the stars. And it's just, it's like, there seems to have been, there definitely has been a lot of lost knowledge from those times. We still don't know how they constructed the pyramids, I apologize for taking you down this huge rabbit hole. I want to be able to talk about your stuff. This is always,
honestly, I am here for this. I'm here for this conversation. I think this is the most important conversation that humans can have these days, because again, to come back to your original question about the maturity crisis, the maturity crisis exists in all of that lost knowledge, right? We've gained all of these specialist skills, whether it's as a machine gunner, whether it's as a carpenter, whether it's as a quantum entanglement, whatever.
Researcher, yeah.
Right? Rocket scientist, whatever. Like, we have all these skills and we've created all this stuff as a result, right? Rockets and medicine and et cetera, et cetera. This computer that we're talking on right now. But we have lost something deep in our essence, which is true connection with all beings. And yeah, if you look at these megalithic structures, again, I don't know if you follow or are aware of, what's his name? The TV show is...
Graham Hancock?
Graham Hancock, yeah, thank you. Ancient yep. Apocalypse. You know, his theory is that these buildings, we were building them a long time before 12,000 years ago. And there was this knowledge of the stars and how the universe works that we've largely lost. And all these like shared myths from all around the world about serpents in the sky and, you know, all of this kind of stuff. Gods and heroes coming out of the water. We've lost that. And if you listen to indigenous teachers, indigenous elders, and the way they talk about the land and the way, you know, the humility, you know, one of the things that I love about Northern American indigenous culture is that they view humans as the little brother. We're the youngest of all the relations. And so it's our job to learn from the salmon, the cedar, the mountain, the, you know, all these, the raven and the coyote and all the animals and all the plants. They're the teachers because they've existed largely unchanged for hundreds of millions of years, if not billions of years. And so there's this element of wonder that doesn't really exist and certainly isn't encouraged in our society, right?
My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader. Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
We are obsessed with control. We're obsessed with certainty. We're obsessed with safety, and the real magic and connection, and, you know, and this is maybe now a segue into my work and what I do, is in the wonder, is in the mystery, right? Is in the awe of, I cannot comprehend what I'm experiencing. And for that to be enough, to not have to go and figure it out and put it in a box and know what it all means, but to just exist with the mystery and allow that mystery to do its work. And this is now, we're into kind of Bill Plotkin and soul work, where when you go on a vision quest, it's not to get answers. It's not to figure anything out. It's not to solve any problem. It's to open yourself to experience mystery and maybe receive some little download that is a piece of the myth that is you. And when we receive that and we sit with it and we start to understand why we are and when we are and who we are, then when we come back to the village, when we come back into society, our actions have more power. They have more weight behind them because whatever we've gathered from this experience out in the wild is now driving us, is driving our actions. So even if the action is the same, even if the, you know, who I thought I was before my vision quest hasn't changed since the vision quest, what I've received will make my actions more aligned, will make my medicine more potent, whatever that medicine is.
Yeah, and you said a lot there, and I promise I will continue along this thread, but I wanted, like, I think it was interesting you'd mentioned specifically with like the Northern American tribes having this awe and an intent around extracting lessons from the world around us. It's another one of those things where I wonder, because we keep finding proof of Homo sapiens going farther and farther back, and also other offshoots, you know, of these kind of like distant ancestors of human-like species, like Homo floresiensis and things like that. And it's like, you know, those people, if you, you know, we know that there was an impact on Earth like 11,800 years ago or 11,600 years ago, I can't remember. And it wiped out most of life on Earth. And these people, you know, these Northern American tribes, my understanding is that we believe that, you know, those are the descendants of people who walked across the Bering Land Bridge when that was exposed, when there was so much ice on, and that the seas were receding because everything was freezing, and they've come across and meandered down, you know, some of them, you know, down to the warmer parts of North America and have settled here. And it's like, you know, they were around in the times, if that lineage does go back that far, like those are people that tie back to the survivors of that time, and potentially the remnant that were, or do trace back to these old civilizations. And it's like, what is that? Some of that is some genetic wisdom coming down, but like what has been passed down in those stories? It's those same things as like the, you know, the Bible was passed. It was word of mouth stories passed down the chain until someone finally wrote something down eventually. And it is, but then it comes into, we know the Library of Alexandria was burned multiple times. And also like during the Crusades, the Vatican now has all of these, so much, who knows what, it's, you know, billions of dollars of assets tucked away in this weird little, you know, its own state inside of Italy, where it's like they're beholden to no one. And it's just tying back into what you had said earlier with these, you know, they're being the powers that be, they're being a lot of this lost knowledge, all of this interest tying back to other things. It all does kind of seem like you can connect the dots. And I know I'm making leaps here, but it is, I think, taking the time to think about these things, which you obviously have, it is important to stop and consider those things. But in bringing that back to the other things that you just touched on near the end of that, you know, the outdoors is a very powerful place to me. And it has been, it was that way when I could see, but it was in recovering after I lost my sight, and it still plays a very big role in my life, whether that be getting out and skiing or surfing or rock climbing or whitewater kayaking and just being immersed in it. And I think there's a couple parts to that of in doing those things out in nature, yes, there are no distractions, but it's also in doing hard things out in nature, you have to be so locked into what you're doing that it does You know, I think the idea of the vision quest that you've talked about sounds like, and definitely can be, and in ancient times was a more long term, drawn out meta process. But like today, it doesn't have to be that way. You can still discover those little pieces of yourself. Maybe you're not in a place where you can get out into the mountains, but I think specifically in forcing yourself to do hard things that are extremely difficult and make you extremely uncomfortable. And in that, again, you have the choice to be doing that, and you are forcing yourself to do that, and you could quit at any time, but you're not, I think is another place where you start to get little pieces of that and that larger awareness of yourself, and that awareness, and those insights into yourself and your own character. And a lot of times identifying sources of weakness through those trials that you can then be cognizant of and work to eliminate as weaknesses by expanding yourself into those areas where you've noticed those gaps in yourself, I think is a lot. I mean, that is today, I think that is the way that a lot of people do it, even though they don't realize that they're doing it. And I think for the people that don't commit to that, miss that. And it's easy to write off that idea of that still needing to be an important part of today's life. And I think people who write that off, again, are maybe not thinking in a larger picture and trying to connect these dots, right? Like, it is, because there is such a fire hose of information everywhere, mm-hmm. and you can pick and choose where your information is coming from so that you go down a path that is not necessarily going to facilitate any form of growth, or you challenging yourself even mentally, far, far less getting to the point of doing it physically. But I mean, you've had a life yourself of mountaineering and putting yourself in these situations that, like, I know you set a world record in, well, it was 2011 for the rock climbing. And what led you down that? Did someone else instill this in you, or how did you end up on this path? And then we can follow that into what you are doing with all of this.
Yeah, I love it. I want to just put a pin in this idea of an easy life, because that's what you were just referencing, deliberately taking on difficult and challenging things and what comes from that. But just very quickly, to go back to what you were saying about the Bible and how it was a kind of oral tradition that eventually was written down. The other piece is it's been translated and translated and translated.
Yes.
And I just wanted to very quickly share, I don't know if you've ever heard this, but it's an original Aramaic translation of the Lord's Prayer. I'll just share the first few lines, because it's the same, but it's wildly different. So it starts, "O cosmic birther of all radiance and vibration, soften the ground of our being and carve out a space within us where your presence can abide. Fill us with your creativity so we may be empowered to bear the fruit of your mission. Let each of our actions bear fruit in accordance with our desire. Endow us with the wisdom to produce and share what each being needs to grow and flourish. Untie the tangled threads of destiny that bind us as we release others from the entanglement of past mistakes." Well, I know I've read most of it, so I might as well continue. "Do not let us be seduced by that which would divert us from our true purpose, but illuminate the opportunities of the present moment. For you are the ground and the fruitful vision, the birth, power, and fulfillment, as all is gathered and made whole once again."
Wow. Do you have that on your wall in your office right now where you're at? Is that where you were reading that off of?
I don't have it on my wall.
Okay.
I just pulled it up on my phone.
Okay. I was just, that it's very, I mean, it's aligned with what you have been saying as well, but these are, you know, a lot of that, it's crazy that goes back who knows how long, and it's still very accurate to the human, you know, to being human and the mm-hmm. meaning of being human. It's hitting the nail on the head with all of it. Like that is still, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, to me, it's pointing at this idea of a greater consciousness, but it doesn't have, you know, one of my challenges with, I was brought up Catholic. One of my challenges with Christianity in general, but Catholicism in particular, is the judgment and the guilt that is baked into it. Of like, you're born a sinner and you live your whole life as a sinner, and so many versions of so many religions have some theme of that. And when you actually dig in to actually like, who was Jesus and what did Jesus actually talk about? It's all this. It's all like, live in alignment with the higher vibration of wholeness, of love, and the path will be revealed. And you know, I love a description of Jesus that he wasn't some miracle worker. He wasn't some alien with healing powers. He was just incapable of seeing someone in anything other than their wholeness. He didn't see the leprosy. He didn't see the poverty. He didn't see the whatever the affliction was. And his belief in that person's wholeness caused them to heal because it was so strong. I mean, that's a whole other topic that we could spend hours talking about. So you asked me how did I end up here? I'll talk about that, and then I'll loop back to this idea of an easy life. The short answer is I climbed out of my cot before I could walk. I have always had this deep urge to be higher up, to be further away, to get out of the village. So I think I was quite hard work as a child, because I mean, my parents have stories up the wazoo of me. I'm honestly surprised I'm still here today. That the number of times that I've come within a hair's breadth of tragedy is remarkable. So that's always been in me. But what has also always been in me is this dis-ease with all of the systems that we talked about already. So I was very fortunate, you might say, to go to one of the most prestigious boarding schools in England. The same school that Kate Middleton, now Princess Middleton, went to. And it was a deeply traumatic experience for me. My parents were living in Dubai, so I was like, from the age of 9, I was like flying halfway around the world by myself. But through the whole thing, I was just like, what are these people doing? What are we doing here? This doesn't make sense. And so from a very early age, all of these systems that we exist within, from the education system to democracy itself, for some reason, I've always had like a glimpse behind the veil and have seen how these systems are used to control. You know, democracy increasingly less and less is about a voice for all the people, right? And as we talked about, the healthcare system has nothing to do with health. And
yeah,
all of these systems, like in concert with each other, are ripping us from our soul. And so I've spent most of my life really struggling with this because I've never been good at holding down a job. I've never been good at fitting in and being that conformist that capitalism requires. And so I've struggled as a result. I've lived in squats in South London. I've been, you know, this close to homeless a number of times. And through all of that, adventure has been the thing that has kept me anchored, right? It's like it's a paradox, but when I learned to rock climb when I was 14, thanks in large part to this school that I went to that had an outdoor activities department, and we had a climbing wall like in the school, and we would go on trips to Wales and various places around the UK. What I realized when I started kind of doing my own personal work and looking back, I thought I was just having fun, but actually clinging to the side of a rock face by my fingernails was the first time I'd ever really felt safe, because A, I had chosen to be there, B, I felt alive, and that's something that was always a struggle for me, was feeling alive in my lessons, in my church, in you know, all these different silos of modern life. But when I'm in the wilderness, I feel the connection to the thing that I have never been taught how to understand. Right, I can't speak the language. Still to this day, I would say I can't speak the language, but I can feel it. I can, and I feel the wholeness and the interconnectedness of the web of life. And yeah, my job as I see it is to reintroduce people to the wild. Because what I see over and over and over and over and over and over again is that the medicine that is delivered by even a 2-hour experience is so precise for that person. And it's different for everyone, and it's never what you anticipate. You know, I'm thinking of an example of a guy who came, and our goal was to climb a mountain here in Squamish. And within 5 minutes of setting off on the hike, he said, "I got what I came for." And it was simply for him, he'd come from LA, and simply for him just being in the forest and seeing how everything is tangled together and everything relies on each other, that opened up his mind and solved the challenge that he had brought. And that was just in the first 5 minutes. So yeah, so there are other nuts and bolts, right? There's a leadership aspect that I bring in, there's a spirituality aspect that I bring in, but ultimately at its core, It's reintroducing people to who they are underneath the masks that they have to wear day in, day out, right? The masks of being a man or a mother or a fireman or a cyclist or a whatever it might be. Because nature doesn't care about any of those labels.
Yeah, you get a lot of, just even like that, and it's, on one hand, it made me think, like, sounds crazy that that's all it took. And then I remember, like, sometimes I forget I've had a really cool life where I've been able to do a lot of this stuff and then continue to be able to do a lot of this stuff. So like I get out into that, but you don't think about, yeah, maybe that guy's never left LA, you know, or that the metro area around LA, and this is him coming the first time he's literally ever been out of a city or an urban area. Are you getting a lot of people that are lost in the way of not having a sense of direction in life coming to you? Is it like that guy where it's, hey, I've been in a city my entire life. Is it all of the above? Like, what is setting the stage for these things?
It's generally the people who I work with they're not the completely lost, but they are the looking for more. They're looking for deeper meaning, right? They're often very successful inside of the rubric of success, and yet life feels flat. They dread Monday mornings. They are waking up to, even if they're not conscious of it yet, they're waking up to the cost that they have carried, which is their relationship with their kids, which is their health, which is their, general state of well-being, their fulfillment. And they're asking themselves big questions. What am I doing? Why am I here? Is this worth it? What's the meaning of it all? And so generally they tend to be quite self-aware. You know, they've usually, I work with a lot of coaches. So they tend to be quite self-aware. And at the same time, I'm currently talking to a guy in Kenya about how I can support him. He runs a halfway house for boys who have been sexually abused. And how can we bring adventure experiences to help them take off those masks, right? And reconnect with who they are underneath the trauma of that whole world.
And you could have a massive impact on their lives by opening that door. I mean, a lot of times that is having a vessel to open the door to explore those things in a way that is not so direct and not so clinical is what people need to be able to start moving past some of that stuff and to start putting in the work of which, and you know, these are children. It's not like they can, like, they're not going to have, they need some guidance there to be able to do that. I meant that putting in the work part, I guess, more as in terms of speaking of adults in a larger context, but like that is there a real possibility that you're going to be able to make that happen and support them?
It's very early days. I have no idea what it would look like, but if I if I take myself, right, one of the things that I do with my clients is it's called future pacing, right? Let's take a step forward 5 years or 10 years and inhabit your life as you've created it perfectly for you. But if I do that for myself and I imagine a world where I have projects doing this all over the world, my whole being lights up. So if I can make it happen, I will. You know, not just with him, but with people like him all over. And I as I imagine the Altitude Evolution universe being full of people like him, and I can go and train him in how to do this work. And then he becomes the Kenya guy, and he trains other people who are doing important work with other, you know, populations. If that ends up being the impact that I've had on that work, on this world, well, I think I can check out saying good job.
And you've made a meaningful impact that is also going to be multiplied, because some of those people are going to go on to want to have the same impact you had, and they will take up down that same path and continue passing that torch along. And that's how these things happen. Like, it's, you know, it's really interesting that this is where we ended up going. This is, I expected us to discuss a lot of your mountaineering and stuff like this, and I'm glad that we've been able to get onto a deeper level here. But like yesterday, I recorded an episode with another gentleman he's a veteran, and he ended up going down the path of becoming basically, you know, and he started a nonprofit doing these outdoor experiences specifically for veterans who were struggling. And because of the same mechanism that you're talking about, where it does, you know, purpose came up a lot in our conversation yesterday. So did the idea of, hey, this opens doors, like I had just said, where that you may not be ready to address this thing head on, but this is an avenue for you to do it in another way and to bring other people along in the healing process. And it is just this almost kind of guardrails to help nudge that along. And it is like, I think people might dismiss the potential impact of these kinds of settings, and whether that be something that you're doing or something that you may end up doing, either if it's not with this gentleman in Kenya, I'm sure you're going to end up finding another way to do this in another climb in place. But these, you know, for me, I've already kind of touched on it, but like getting to go to adaptive sports facilities where I can go get out and ski still, totally blind, just with the radio, I'm on my own skis and all that stuff. And it's, you know, early on for me, that was having some independence again after I had lost all of it. Sure. And it just, that impact of getting to feel that again in such a way that was so far removed from any really like application for real life, you know, like being able to ski again did nothing to help me in the way of being able to cook or live and get back out on my own.
And it
stuff.
Did everything.
Yes. And it is so, like, if I hope that people in hearing us go down all these paths can stop and recognize the potential for these. I mean, it can be a treatment modality.
100%.
Yes.
And it is. And it's one of the most effective treatment modalities for like gang members, for veterans, for abuse sufferers, because it bypasses a lot of the shielding. And, you know, when you and me step out onto a mountain together, there is, whether it's explicit or not, there is a contract between us that we've got each other's backs. Right. And it's the same, right? It's the same in the military, right? When you go out into combat, you better hope that those guys have got your back, right? And vice versa. And so there's a vulnerability that comes with that, where even on a, like, it doesn't need to be some death-defying, you know, alpine peak. Even a basic hike, just being in the forest, right here in BC, it's just forest. Everywhere is forest. And like what happened with that client that I mentioned, it's like you set foot in that forest, and especially if you're not accustomed to that environment, it's like the vulnerability of, like, we're here together, and there might be bears, and there might be weather, and there might be physical challenges, right? And this comes back to what you were saying earlier. It's that vulnerability that opens that door and creates that safety if it's held properly, right? Because a wilderness experience can be just as traumatic as a war zone, or, right, if it's not managed properly, if it's not held. But if it is held, and if I'm able to create the conditions where someone feels safe, that opens the door to a profound healing and a deep level of conversation that might not be possible on a call with a therapist or in some other, you know, more traditional treatment modality. And the other piece of it is what you were saying earlier about intentionally choosing challenge, right? I said I wanted to talk about an easy life. This is a distinction that I got the other day. So I went up, I have a friend who lives off-grid up in the mountains behind Squamish. And she lives in this tiny little cabin, and she has a, it's called micro hydro, which is like a, basically like a little mini hydroelectric power plant that powers just her house. And that requires a lot of maintenance, right? Because it takes water out of the creek, funnels it down to a little turbine. And we had a storm and she lost her power. So she asked me to go and help her figure out what was going on. So she's been living there for 16 years by herself, doing all of this stuff by herself. And she needed help because she's busted her knees. She tore her MCL and ACL. So she's like hobbling around on crutches. So first of all, even she's like 70, even hobbling around on crutches, she still hiked up a mountain, right, with me.
The hard woman, man.
Yeah, serious. And then we spent 2 or 3 hours literally throwing rocks around in this pool to rebuild the dam that was damaged in a storm, so that the water would get funneled into the bucket so that it would come down the and it was, right, it's hard work, right? I'm like up to my knees in the river, moving boulders around that are like a foot in diameter. They probably weigh like, you know, 100 pounds. Hard work. The fulfillment that I felt when we got that water going where it, where she needed it to go, and then we got back to the house and the turbine spun up and the lights came on, it's like, fuck, man, I've done something real. I've actually coexisted with the environment to create power.
Wow. Which is such a crazy prospect. Like,
right?
Yeah.
And we're like, and
as we were talking, she shared this insight that she'd had recently about ease not being the goal. We're so, like, life is so set up to be, or we want it to be easier. We always want life to be easier, right? We want less struggle. We want less discomfort. We want to be more comfortable. We want squishier shoes. We want, right, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But all of our efforts to make life easy only make it harder because they insulate us from the real experience of living.
And you have to be very, very mindful of that and like set up. With the obesity crisis in this country, I guess most people probably aren't aware that you need to be mindful of that and set things up and know that, hey, your brain is still operating on this paradigm of I'm better off with the most calories I can get in and the least I can expend. I'm happy because I'm storing fat for a survival situation, even though rarely is anyone, at least in this country, you know, ever in that sort of situation. And it's just, again, where you have to know that you can live this frictionless life, but you shouldn't just because you can.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, what a great example food is, right? How many Americans get all of their food out of a box of some sort?
I think it's probably the a majority. I don't know right? if it is the vast majority, but it's definitely a majority. Yeah.
Right. And how easy. I go to the store, I buy the box of cereal, I buy the box of pasta, I take it home, I empty the box into the pan, I add some water, and I get mac and cheese. Easy, delicious. What does that create? It creates heart disease, it creates inflammation, it creates obesity, it creates depression, it creates a whole host of difficult things. Whereas you need food, you go out in the forest with a bow and arrow and you track a deer for 3 days and you kill the deer, that food is a celebration. And you've got stronger, you've got healthier, right? It's like, do the hard thing now and have the ease later. Whereas we want it the other way around. We're like, we want it to be easier now, and that just makes it hard later. I remember a friend of mine, a very wise friend of mine, told me something his mentor said to him, which is difficult conversations, easy life. Easy conversations, difficult life. Right? It's the same thing. I don't want to speak the truth because I might upset you. So I take the easy option and I keep it stuffed down. And then I do that again tomorrow, and then I do that again tomorrow, and then I do that again tomorrow because it's easy and I don't want it to be difficult. I don't want to make a scene. I don't want to upset you or offend you. And then in 3 years or 3 months or whatever it is, I lose my shit and now we're getting a divorce, or now I've gone and shot up a school or whatever it might be. We have this like allergic reaction to anything difficult. But if we're willing to be with that and embrace the challenge, right? And it's the same with the gym, right? The gym can suck. I don't want to get up at 6 a.m. and go and get sweaty and, right? But the benefits last forever. And not forever, but it's like a hard thing that leads to a positive result. Cold plunging, same thing. Sauna, same thing. It's like, it's not pleasant to go cold plunging.
I cold plunge most days, and I feel like a bitch every time I get in that thing.
Yeah.
I just feel like such a pussy when I'm in there every day. It has not gotten any easier. The gym and stuff, you know, it is. If you're doing it right, you should always be pushing yourself more. So, like, yes, it doesn't. It gets easier in terms of the mental battle because you build the discipline. But, like, physically, if my body fucking hurts, I don't want to go lift today. I got strangled for an hour of jiu-jitsu this morning, and I need to go lift after we get out of here. And my body is going to hurt while I'm lifting because but you have to do that stuff, baby. It's just, like, it's frustrating because it is such a simple thing to do. I realize that does not mean it's easy, but it is such a simple thing. And you don't have to have gym equipment to work out. You don't have to. Obviously, not everyone has access to a cold plunge or a sauna or whatever, but it's like the excuse shouldn't be, oh, I don't have a gym. It's like, all right, bitch, go do air squats and burpees and push-ups and sit-ups and go walk, go run, go find a hill that's free. Like, do something and start somewhere. That's the other thing you hear people talk about is like, it's I'm so far away from that right now. Like that's better. That you have to do literally any change in your lifestyle will start to make a change in your mental health and your physical health and your metabolic health and your overall well-being. Like if you are listening to this and you're 300 pounds, if you start walking even 3 times a week right now, you will start to see a difference in yourself and you can start to ramp things up as you go. And everything else comes along with that. The mental toughness and discipline starts to follow along. So long as on those days where you really don't want to do it, you still make yourself do it. Like it's again, not easy, simple though.
Yeah. And I have a distinction around that as well, right? Which is the confidence courage distinction. We think that what we need is confidence to get started. I need to know how it's all going to pan out. I need to know what the end result is going to be. I can't take this risk because I don't know if it will succeed. I'm not confident, so I'm going to wait. But what we actually need is one moment of courage, right? If you're that 300-pound person, it takes courage to get up and go for a 5-minute walk or a 10-minute walk, right? It takes real courage because when you're not used to trusting your body, you don't know if you can. And it's scary. You don't know if you're going to fall over and not be able to get back up. It's a very, right? That's a real risk. And confidence is the result of taking a courageous action.
And that momentum carries.
Yeah.
It absolutely does.
Yeah. Because it feels good I have a saying, which is every time you do something that scares you, an old story dies and a new one starts to get written. Because if my story is I can't walk anywhere and I choose to live inside of that story every day, well, that's going to keep being my story. But if I can do the scary thing and get up and walk to the shops instead of driving, I have proved that story to be false. And now the story is I can walk a short distance. And now I can inhabit that place. And I can walk a short distance regularly. And then the stretch becomes, well, can I walk around the park for half an hour? And that's scary. But then you become the person who can walk around the park for half an hour. And then the idea comes, maybe I could run a little bit. And you run 10 paces. And you're like, holy shit, I ran.
Right? My lungs are on fire and I hate myself for it, but tomorrow it's going to be awesome. Yeah.
But I did it.
Yes.
I did it. And And that's how small it can be. And it's, each one of those is a courageous act, right? And it doesn't need to be some big thing. But, you know, you reference my world record. That was a courageous act. That was when I made the decision to do that. A big part of the reason that I did it was because I wasn't very fit. And I wanted some external accountability to keep me on track. And what happened, as soon as I went public with this is what I'm doing, that became my identity, and my whole life arranged itself around that. So suddenly there was no question of, am I going to go and spend 4 hours on the rowing machine? Because I had decided to be someone who would climb for 24 hours. And someone who can climb for 24 hours loves spending 4 hours on the rowing machine.
Yeah, and then you're ready for more when you get off.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so
the courageous act of saying, I will do this, I will be this, meant that, right, there was an order form to the universe, and the universe or God or spirit or creator, however you want to, whatever works for you, was like, okay, message received. I can put the wheels in motion. I can put the things in place. And so I was working a full-time job as an assistant editor for a commercial, a TV commercial company. And I didn't have any time to go to the gym when I started. Within a week of making that decision, suddenly I had 10 hours a week to be in the gym.
Yeah, you make the time.
I literally created the time. Nothing changed apart from my decision that I have the time.
Yeah.
And then other decisions just started happening. I gave up drinking. I changed the way I ate. My energy level started to increase. I became alive. I became this vibrant being. And it was effortless. It like didn't actually require very much from me after that one courageous choice. And then every day choosing to still be that. Like giving up smoking is a great example. It's like, as long as you're trying to give up smoking or trying to lose weight or trying to get fit, you are operating from an identity that cannot do that. And so I used to smoke. I used to go out on a night out with 4 packs of cigarettes and they would all be gone by the morning.
Holy shit.
Like, I didn't smoke all of those cigarettes, but I also smoked some cigarettes that weren't mine.
Yeah.
At the time, taking 10 to 20 ecstasy tablets and speed and cocaine and whatever else. The way that I gave up smoking was an instant decision. I don't smoke. And years and years and years of trying to quit had failed because I was subconsciously programming myself that I need smoking, that smoking is a reward, that when I do something stressful, the only way I can relax afterwards is a cigarette, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All these like pieces of my story. And so from inside of that, whenever I was trying to quit and something hard would come up, immediately, you need a cigarette. You need a cigarette because cigarettes are how you deal with hard things. But the moment I flipped that switch, and it's a very easy thing to say, but not so easy in practice. I mean, it can be, but often it's not. But the moment I made that decision, I am not a smoker. Well, if I'm not a smoker, then I don't need a cigarette as a reward for doing something great. I don't need a cigarette to come down off a challenging experience. And it was instant.
Go ahead.
No, that's it was instant.
Yeah, that's, I can't relate with the it being instant thing, but that's interesting. So I struggled with alcoholism for a long time and I'm sober now, but I've always tried it when people, you know, sometimes people just like they can't wrap their minds around being addicted to something. And when you're talking about it, like they just, it's like the questions will just keep coming of like, no, but like how you can't like, you couldn't just stop or whatever. And it, whatever the questions may be, I've never, and I use that same thing, like you just said of, yeah, it was anytime something hard happened, I would drink. And then the more each time, you know, over time, the bar for something to be difficult enough or uncomfortable enough for me to drink decreased less and less and less. And so before long, I was just drinking over anything. But like, I've never heard someone say that cigarettes were kind of that way, and the extent of I do it to blow off steam after something uncomfortable. I feel stupid like realizing that now that I've never realized that it functions that in a similar capacity for some smokers.
Well, that's anything that we're addicted to: gambling, sex, porn, TV. What makes it an addiction is that we use it to avoid our difficult feelings, that we turn to it in our times of challenge because we have created a world where we don't have the capacity to be with that thing. And like you referenced owning that, right? Actually being willing to say, I have a problem here, is the first step of deciding to be something different. And that's right. And now we're back to a courageous act.
Right? And the first step and yeah. Building momentum. It's all coming full circle again. Uh-huh. It's just, it is. And it's a lot of these things, you know, and I've had a lot of deep conversations on here, and they usually, you know, these big, you know, accurate takeaways that someone has on something typically do extrapolate and can be abstracted into other scenarios. Like these are general lessons that do apply to being human that are applicable in different contexts. And it's just, that's why I love these conversations, whether it's, they've been all over the gamut so far of the different realms that we've kind of gone into, but there, you always find these nuggets of some human experience that someone listening, I mean, there were a bunch of golden little nuggets kind of buried in here. And it's just these, again, just being frank with people and being willing to kind of dive into the minutia of things really opens a lot of this stuff up to, yes, it's set here, but now it's also there for someone else to take that insight and do with it what they may, right? Like that can have an impact on someone's lives. And it's such a beautiful thing because outside of these, I guess, and there's not a lot of other situations where you just sit down specifically with the intent of talking to someone for an hour and a half or 2 hours. And that is the only planned thing that you have to do is, hey, we're going to sit here and talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just. And so again, to come back right full circle to the very beginning of this conversation, right? That's what life used to be about. We didn't work 12-hour days. We did 3 or 4 hours of gathering or unless it was a hunt, right? And then we sat around the fire and we told stories. And we passed wisdom from one person to another. And we shared myths and legends that helped us learn about the world, that helped us learn about each other, that helped us learn about ourselves. And that's largely missing.
Oh, I'm excited. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I want to just take a minute to celebrate you for being a facilitator of powerful conversations like this. And I hope that someone listening has got something from whatever we've spoken about today that will change their life, that will change the way they see something, that will inspire them to take some courageous action. Because that really is what it's all about.
Yeah, thanks for being willing to come on and just let it run. I mean, I told you, this is how these conversations go. We go wherever they end up. But I appreciate you being willing to entertain that and stick around and take the, just follow it with me. Cause this was totally the opposite, not the opposite. This is not what I was expecting this conversation to be, but I'm so happy that this is what it turned into. And what I was about to say when you started saying that was, I I'm very excited to see where this goes for you specifically. You'll have to keep me posted on what happens with this gentleman in Kenya or any other, whatever this, because I feel 100% confident that you're going to end up going down this path, whether it's with him or someone else, just from what we've talked about. I mean, it seems like this is where you're headed, and I want to know how it turns out and where you end up going with down that lane of this mission that you're on, man. It's just, I'm excited for you and excited to kind of be a bystander with it. And I think this is a pretty beautiful place to wrap this up with, it coming full circle again. Outside of, you know, Altitude Evolution, I will have your website in the show notes and all that stuff. Where else should people find you or reach out at, or what else do you want to plug?
Thanks for the invitation and thanks for having me on. This has been so much fun. I love the way this went. Like, I literally came in with the intention to go in blind. And it's like, it's such an apt metaphor for my message in the world, is we're all blind. We think we can see, but we can't. And if we're willing to put down what we think we know, what we think we believe, what we think is the truth of the way the world is and the way I am and the way you are and the way they are, and we're willing to open ourselves to the mystery of the unknown, that's a beautiful thing. And I think that is the path to healing the wounds that humanity is experiencing right now, is a willingness to sit in the mystery with someone else who may or may not share the same views, who may or may not have the same history, who may or may not, right? There's so many different things they may or may not, and none of it matters, because none of us have any idea what we're doing. None of us. So yeah. I love that this has been an exploration into the wilderness of the mind. In terms of getting in touch, I love talking to people. I would love to have a conversation with anyone who has any questions, or I'd love to hear if anyone has been inspired by anything that we've talked about. Probably Instagram is the easiest way to get in touch with me. The handle is Altitude Evolution, all one word. You can contact me through the website, altitudeevolution.com. If I was going to plug anything, where I'm putting my focus is on leadership teams. Because I believe that the wilderness can solve a lot of the dysfunctions of a team. And so just an open invitation for anyone who wants to lead better, who wants to lead in a more conscious way, who wants to open their heart and their soul to the mysteries of the web of life. Let's talk.
Awesome. Well, thanks, man. You know, I really enjoyed this, and I think people are going to get a lot out of this conversation. So thank you for taking the time.
Thank you. It's been an absolute honor.
And thanks everyone at home for listening to another episode of Going In Blind. Please, if you haven't already, rate and review the show wherever you're listening right now, and then share this with another curious mind who needs to hear it.